Okay, everyone. It is March 13th, 2017. Those of us in the New York area, we're waiting for a big snowstorm, but let us begin. I want to start with a comment that Yisrael mailed to me. Yisrael, who is with us now. If you recall, at the end of the last class, I made the claim that I thought that the originator of the notion of kiruv, that is outreach, was Rav Kook. And I spoke about the mission that he did in the north to those kibbutzim where Rav Charlap went with him, and even Rav Zonenfeld went with him. And Yisrael made the claim that actually Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch precedes him. And then he said, he mentioned that Hirsch had opened a folk shula. Here it is. Okay, I found it. That's I'm looking in Krugman's biography, page 226. But actually, Krugman is citing, he's not an original researcher, he's citing from Mordechai Breuer. But I have that this famous book, Modernity Within Tradition, The Social History of Orthodox Jewry in Imperial Germany. And but it's it's easier to have the Krugman volume. I have to say that I had totally forgotten this information, even though I know the Breuer book, at least I did know it, very backwards and forwards, and Krugman book as well. Here it is in the Krugman book on page 208. It mentions the founding of the Volksschule, which is a school for, it'll be for more trades and things like that, not more the academic type of school. And it begins in 1882 with 36 students, and in a few years, it has 290 students, and then it's devoted to the East European Jews. Something which I said, although Breuer doesn't mention that. I'm looking at Breuer here, which is the source for... yeah, it does say on the previous page there are many Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, and they had been going to the public schools, so Hirsch decided to found a school for them. So thank you, Yisrael. I mean, I had forgotten that. My point is correct, that the real immigration comes later than that, but there was an immigration. And furthermore, as Yisrael points out, it's mentioned that Hirsch tried to recruit students from the irreligious to go to his school. I mean, we often think of him as being an Austrian person, but that was really only when it came to communal ties. But in terms of individuals, he had no opposition to the non-religious, who he thought were simply misled by their rabbis. And he did engage in outreach. So I have to say that Yisrael, although before last week's class, I would have said that, and I did say that Rav Kook is the originator of Kiruv, I think you've convinced me now that really you have to look at Hirsch. I mean, day schools, which try to bring in people who are not observant, that's the ultimate in outreach. Now, you also made the point that even Rav Kook wouldn't have been in, as you said, standing on the street corner like Chabad. So I can't claim that, what Hirsch did is really not Kiruv. It's no different than... What Rav Kook did, and you're right, Rav Kook didn't stand on street corners. And then you make the claim that quite apart from Kiruv in that sense of actual reaching out to the irreligious, which I think we need to now point to Hirsch for what he did, and those who were here last week, some of you I see weren't, and I'm still very impressed because I'm getting all these emails, but none of those people are with me live. But I already said that... you know, Hirsch, the whole idea of women's education, girls' education, goes back to Hirsch, and he gets absolutely no credit. Everything goes to Sarah Schneier, and Sarah Schneier would have been unimaginable without Hirsch. In fact, in Breuer's book, which I'm holding, in the very last pages, the very last page, I think, or the second to last page, I just thought of it. I'm not going to find it now. He talks about all the things that would have been unimaginable without German Orthodoxy. And one of them he mentions is, girls' education. It's in the last chapter. But then you say that all of his writings as well. He has the 19 letters. He has Choreth. He has his Chumash commentary, which these are written in German. So they're clearly appealing to not the scholars. But I don't know. Well, that's a little bit more iffy because plenty of people had written in the vernacular. Let me take it back. Not plenty, but you had people written in the vernacular. And it is true that the 19 letters is not just for the religious. It's for everyone. Goetz himself was turned on to Hirsch from that. And there are plenty of people who their attitude towards traditional Judaism were turned around. But normally you don't think in terms of writing as Kiruv. But if you're going to say that writing is a form of Kiruv, then indeed Hirsch has to be given credit for that as well. And finally you say, and this is really interesting, that the whole reason of him going to Frankfurt in the first place was Kiruv. To go from Moravia and the tens of thousands of his leadership to a community of 100 members where there was barely a minion, that was like the first Chabad Shlichus. With that I take issue, however, because, and I speak a lot about this in my trip to Central Europe, because we actually go to Nikolsburg and we see Hirsch's house, and I talk about this unbelievable thing that he leaves a community where he's chief rabbi in all of Moravia. I think he had 32 communities under him, to go to this little small breakaway minion. They couldn't even call it a shul. They had to call it a society. But I don't see that as Kiruv. I see that as bringing what he thought was the light of Torah to the true believers. Is that Kiruv? Kiruv we think of for the irreligious. When he went to Frankfurt, on the contrary, he was going to the most religious. And you can make the claim that if he really, it would have been a greater act of Kiruv to do what the Matzei Levi, Mordechai Horovitz, did, and that is to be part of the mainstream community where you can reach other people. So of your three or four things, I'll take issue with the last one, but I accept your comment, your correction, that Hirsch. And Moshe says, what about Rishal Salanter? Rishal Salanter also, I don't know about so much about France. He really was in Germany. And he also had this idea to teach Talmud. He wanted to teach Talmud in the universities. He wanted to translate the Talmud into Russian. This was all about Kiruv as well. I don't think I can't recall him spending that much time in France. I mean, he was centered in Königsberg, but he did go to those places. And Israel Hildesheimer, who taught Torah to girls. And Yisrael Salanter saw this and says, if he tried to do this in Eastern Europe, they put him in Chevrim, but I wish that my share in Olam Haba is the same as his share. So they're engaged in Kiruv, that's a form of Kiruv as well. But I think Yisrael is correct that Hirsch specifically went out to the non-religious to try to bring them into his school. And that is Kiruv. Okay, everyone. Back to Rabbi Charlap. We have a lot to do. Many of his ideas, of course, and then we're going to move into, we have to continue with the biography. How many of you knew that he was the candidate for the chief rabbi, and many people assumed he was the natural person after all, after Rav Kook? Who else should they pick? So we're going to get to all this, but let's pick up where we left off. Let me remind you where we were. I just spent some time dealing with the great controversy over Orot. Now, Rav Kook never responds to the criticism of Chapter 34 and the whole book of Orot, which itself is amazing, and you'd expect him to say something, but he didn't. Now, this book that we're going to speak about briefly, the Tovi Me'orot, that I introduced last class, Rav Charlap gives his interpretation. It's a little strange, I think. What do you mean, his interpretation? He's literally with Rav Kook every single day. He's the closest person in the world to Rav Kook, with the possible exception of his son, and Ritzi Huda, and I don't even know if that's true. He's there at the very time that Rav Kook is being attacked left and right, and he never asked him? I have to assume that what we're reading in Tovi Me'orot is what Rav Charlap received from Rav Kook as the explanation. So why doesn't he say that this is what Rav Kook told me? I think because, as we'll see, he never even regarded himself as worthy to be a student. And for him to say that this is what Rav Kook said, that implies that he understood what Rav Kook told him. I don't think he would ever want to say that because of his image of Rav Kook. But this is what Rav Kook gave him, and then therefore he presents this idea which he understood from Rav Kook, but without actually saying that this is Rav Kook, because then he's saying that what I say is what Rav Kook says, and he doesn't want to, associate Rav Kook's ideas with his meager and lowly way of explaining it, since Rav Kook is obviously, he thinks, on a much higher level. But I have to assume that what we're going to see here, and it fits in completely with Rav Kook's ideas, is as close as you can get to an authorized explanation. And when we say about the attacks, people might think that there's, I'm thinking about what you have today, some of these Paschkavilin that they hang up in Meir Sharim and Geula, which they used to always. But this was much more than that. You had a group of people in their late teens and early 20s, Parush, who we spoke about last semester, was one of them, young fanatics, and they did something they never before done. They started sending out letters. They created these phony groups, one of them like Aguda Kodesh and all these crazy groups, and they started sending out letters to all the big rabbis in Europe on letterhead. So the rabbis, the big rabbis of the cities would get these letters signed from this organization, the Organization for Jewish Purity, the Organization for Holiness in Jerusalem, with the attacks on Rav Kook and all the terrible things he said, and they think that this is some authentic organization. We'll see what Rav Harop says about this. They don't know that this is a bunch of kids, some of them who were doing this, sending it out from the Diskin Orphanage, who were sending it out, making it seem as if there's some great machokas, and the whole city is turning against Rav Kook, when it was, just like I said, a group of kids who were doing this and pulling the wool over everyone's eyes. But it became a big issue, and Rav Harlap had to respond. How did he respond? What was his claim? So let me just summarize some of the things he says. And as I just mentioned, everything in here is in line with Rav Kook's ideas. And you can see this on HebrewBooks.org. The Kuntres is about 16 pages. I just picked out what I think is the most important. Page 8, where he explains that, we'll see the attacks on Rav Harop for this as well, that even those Jews who appear to be sinners and lowly and rejecting all the Torah, nevertheless, internally, they have great light. Externally, when we see them from the outside, things don't look so good. After all, they're Mechal Shabbos, they eat non-kosher, they're rejecting all sorts of things. But that's only from the outside. On the inside, they have a very holy soul. Shemitzad penimiyutam enam be'emet kulam tzadikim. Internally, they're all tzadikim. So here you have Rav Harlap saying that these Sabbath violators are really tzadikim internally. This is very much in line with Rukuk's idea. Namely, you look at them in two ways. The outer approach and the inner. What's coming deep inside them, maybe without them even realizing it. And then he quotes the Pasuk where he says, Ra'uyim l'tehilat tiferet. They deserve praise. These are the people who are defending the Jews against the Arabs. They're clearing the marshes. They're, as we said last class, sacrificing the best years of their life to build up the land of Israel. And he quotes the Pasuk, Va'amcha kulam tzadikim, lo'am yusuart. All your children, all the Jews are tzadikim, because they're involved in building up the land. He's not speaking about the secularists in Europe. And then he goes on to say that even these like weak branches, as it were, enam resukim elami b'chutz, they're not like broken down only externally. Aval lo mipnim. Mipnim ein shum resika ela hakol tamim v'shalem. Everything is complete and pure on the inside. There's that word tamim that I spoke about last class. So here we see, following Rav Kook's approach, a distinction when it deals with the people in the land of Israel, the pioneers, between the outer sins, which we have to feel upset about and try to change, but the internal spark of holiness that they have. We'll see what people have to say about this in a few minutes. Then he goes on. how it's our task to galot masha bifnim. We want to discover what's on the inside, reveal it. Because when we are able to take out the holy inner spark of these pioneers, they don't even realize their holiness, then we can cure the outside. And then he says that this is HaMegamash of Perek Lamadalit, Be'orat HaTchiyah. This is what Rav Kook is getting at in chapter 34. And then he says, who doesn't know, Milo Yedeat, Godo Atzorech, the necessity and the Hechrech, Shehagvura, Gama Gufanit, don't we all know, he says, that we need physical strength to reach prophecy? And then he's going to talk about how we need physical strength for other reasons. So the problem isn't that they're out in the fields and that they're doing sports and that they're strengthening their physical bodies. And Rav Kook spoke about the necessity for physicality. The problem is that they haven't yet recognized the internal holiness to bring that to the fore. And then he explains and he goes and he develops more this idea of how the physicality and to be a gibor and a ranan, and that these are all important and that these are Jewish values. I mean, you can read, this is basically a commentary on chapter 34. And then he continues, page 10. He says that how important it is, l'hamid banim amitzim l'uma, we have to stand up our strong sons for the people. And then he says, "Shemikivan sheba gamitzad hitmasrut l'kal Yisrael." These people dedicate themselves to the Jewish people. Therefore, they're a symbol for us of the oz hagvura, gvurat hakodesh, habasar v'ruach, the holiness of our body. Rav Kook writes in a wrote that we forgot about that our body is also holy. All those years in the galut, the only thing that became holy was the spirit, spiritual things. But we forgot that we also have a holy body, and that God wants us to do holy things with this. And Rav Chalap develops this, and that we have to be dressed once again in a holy body, so that we can be gibori koach. We can be swift like eagles. The gibori ma'ariyot, la'asot ritzon konenu. We have to be strong like a lion. We're not in the Golus anymore. We're returning to the land of Israel. We're building a land. We need strength. We need physical strength to build roads, to build buildings, to defend ourselves. This is how Jews are supposed to live. That's what you find on page 10. And throughout it, he's talking about how, you know, when the internal is able to be shining as well as the external, then we'll have the complete type of Jew that we all strive for. Page 11. When we imagine, he says, the Geula, and that we are so close to the Geula, he says that in this era of being close to the Geula, it's not just that we have a commandment, the Melamed Zchut, to try to find some positive for these people who externally are irreligious. El Neshev Emet Yisrael Kadoshim Eim. It's not that. It's that this isn't just apologetics. This isn't just being Mohammed Slut. This is really, we need these people. And they are doing an important thing in bringing the physicality back to Kol Yisrael. Something that if this was in Poland 200 years ago, this would be a negative thing. Because in Poland 200 years ago, there was no place for the physical. The spiritual was the only thing that was important. But now that we've returned to the land of Israel, we need to recognize the importance of the physical. And that's what Rav Kook is speaking about in Orot, chapter 34. So powerful, important stuff from Rav Charlap. On page 5, he explains, he has a whole theory, which, as I said, I think is Rav Kook, that now that we've returned to the land of Israel, we need a new approach to combating evil. In Chutz La'aretz, how do we combat evil? We combat evil by attacks and things like that, like we know, like they still do it. But in the land of Israel, the approach is not open battle, but rather to show that the evil was really an illusion. And it can't harm people. When you're aware of what it is, it can't harm you. It's really not evil. It's a mistake. And since we're aware of it, we can approach the non-religious in a completely different way to try to bring out the internal holiness that's within them, something that couldn't be done in the diaspora. Now, this is in the all this is, as I said, in the Tovi Meorot, which was published in Elul of 1920. But this wasn't enough. I'll read you in a few minutes what these guys had to say, the Kol HaShofar, which these are the extremists, the fanatics, how not only do they attack Rav Kook, but Rav Chalap also is in their sights. But before we get to that, I have to tell you that this wasn't the only thing that Rav Chalap did. He didn't just publish the Tovi Meorot. He reached out to the most important rabbi politically and also spiritually, the most important rabbi in Europe. If I ask the people listening now, who is the most important rabbi in Europe in the 1920s and the 1930s, I don't know if you're going to get the right answer. Some of you can type it in if you want. Some of you might say Rechavei Sayem. Some of you might say Rafai Moshe Brzezinski. I think the most, and what I'm going to say now might surprise you, but I think the most important one was the Ger Rebbe. Why do I say the Ger Rebbe? Ger Hasidus was the largest Hasidus in the world. In Poland, we're told, supposedly, there were some 200,000 followers of the Ger Rebbe. Now, that doesn't mean that all these were what you think of as a Hasid with the beard and the payas and everything. There was a phenomenon that really doesn't exist anymore today, but the older generation might still remember it, of beardless Hasidim. You had people who would go to Rebbes who felt like they were Hasidim, but they didn't dress the part. Some of them, by the way, today, their children have gone back to the old way of dressing. But you had this phenomenon of the beardless, more worldly Hasidim, but people who still regarded themselves as Hasidim and connected to a Rebbe. When you think about Poland, which was a huge Jewish population, some 3.3 million Jews in the 20s and 30s there, of whom 90% were killed. Agudas Yisrael was a political party in the various city councils and the national government, and the Ger Rebbe, as a leader, someone who could have 100,000, 200,000 people listen to him when he says, vote for this party, that makes him the most important political leader, as well as spiritual, because these were in terms of numbers, sheer numbers, so a very important figure. They say, incidentally, that the second largest group in Poland was the Alexander Hasidim, who were about 25,000. You look around today, there's no Alexander Hasidim left. As with all these groups, they opened up again, Hashtivel in Israel, but they don't exist anymore, and that's because of the Holocaust, completely wiped out. The Ger Rebbe was able, Ger Hasidus survived, because the Ger Rebbe was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael, as we know, and he sent Hasidim to Eretz Yisrael. He would have stayed in Eretz Yisrael himself, but if not for all of Hasidim in Europe. And he sent Hasidim there, so after the war, they were able to start over, and if you read Rabbi Lau's autobiography, he discusses a little bit of this as well. They bought up a lot of property in Tel Aviv. They're very wealthy, the Ger dynasty, but they were able to start over, and in Israel today, the Ger Hasidus is the largest Hasidus in Israel. I want to, about the, one more interesting about Alexander Hasidus is they were not always with Aguda. They ran their own list. For example, in Warsaw, in some of the elections, they ran their own list in opposition to the Aguda, and they actually got a seat in the city council. But the Ger Rebbe was Aguda. So Rav Karlap writes to the Ger Rebbe. This is before the Ger Rebbe comes to Eretz Yisrael to make peace, or try to make peace between the two groups. The Ger Rebbe would come in the spring of 1921. However, in the winter of 1921, that is January 21, Rav Harlap, there's no implication from the letter that he knew the Ger Rebbe was coming. He doesn't say anything like, we hope to see you soon or anything. I mean, he doesn't even know. He had never met the Ger Rebbe by that time. But he writes to him. Now, I'll speak about the Ger Rebbe. Let me read you some of what he says in these letters, and then I'll talk about the Gerer Rebbe's visit and how that becomes very important, especially because in Aguda you had people like Rabbi Chanan Wasserman and a couple others who were inclined to read Rav Kook out of the fold entirely. And when the Gerer Rebbe comes back from the first time of meeting with Rav Kook, and he has a famous letter. Actually, his letter was not from the first visit. His famous letter on the ship was from 27, I think it was the second visit, or maybe the third visit. That immediately means that Rav Kook is kosher for Polish Hasidus, certainly for the Gerer Hasidim, and really for Agudas Yisrael. Well, I'll talk about the Gerer Rebbe in a few minutes. The letter is not actually written to the Gerer Rebbe himself. It's written to the Gerer Rebbe's brother-in-law, Rav Chanotzi Levin, who's the Rav of Benden. I think Rav Chava probably assumed that it's very difficult to get a letter into the Gerer Rebbe with such a big following, so he sends it to Rav of Benden. He's actually called the Rav of Benden, and he comes with him later to Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Levin, and he tells him to, let the Gerer Rebbe know about this. And then this message is repeated when the Gerer Rebbe comes. Let me read you, or summarize for you, the main points of this letter. This letter has just appeared a few years ago in one of the journals in Israel. It has not yet been published in English, which I think it should appear in English. Maybe someone listening wants to do that. I'll put it on the Sfarim blog if you want. Because not only is it a wonderful defense of Rav Kook, it's the most complete defense of Rav Kook in a more simple language. In Tovi Me'orot, he's writing, first of all, he's just focusing on Orot, and second of all, he's writing in very deep Kabbalistic type of spiritual language in some places. This is just a letter which deals with the politics and the people and puts the case of Rav Kook and his approach. So let me summarize it for you. It appeared in Me'avnei HaMakom, which is the Torah journal of the Beit El Yeshiva, if I recall. But you can see it now online if you're interested. So he writes to Rav Benden. He says, I really don't know you, but I'm writing to you. And at the end he says, to pass this on to the Gerer Rebbe. Okay, he says that... Our mutual friend, there was a, I think it was a, he was a Gerer Chassid, yes, in Israel, that received a letter from Rabbi Levin saying that everyone's wondering what's going on there with what Rav Kook wrote. And he showed it to Rav Harlap. So he writes to Rabbi Levin that I see that you're asked, what's going on? A lot of people are questioning the book Orot of Rav Kook. And, people are saying that the great rabbis of Europe should come together and deal with it. Put it in cherem or decide what its place is. And he says, I think it's necessary that don't be nechpazim, don't hurry to judge something when you don't know what's going on. Namely, before you ask Maran Harav Shlita. That is these fanatics who were writing from Jerusalem were trying to get the rabbis, trying to make such a big problem here, make it seem as if there's some heretic who's the Rav of Jerusalem, who's persecuting the authentic Jews and putting forth heretical ideas, and the rabbis need to act. And that there were rabbis who didn't know much, and even the Gerer Rebbe didn't know much. He says that people in Europe are accustomed to think of Rav Kook one way when it's completely different. So Rav Harlap writes, don't you dare... get together and try to make some decision, declarations about what's going on here with the book, with Rav Kook, without knowing the facts. And how do you know the facts? She shalu. Ask Rav Kook, and he will explain. Then he says, I, the insignificant one, have always put myself in the dust of the feet of the great sages, and all the respect of all the sages is upon me. And therefore I ask, about those rabbis who signed in here. I'll talk about this booklet because it does have things written. It was signed, for instance, things against Rav Kook in here were signed by Rabbi Sonnenfeld, for instance, and Yitzhak Yeruchim Diskin. there's some stuff from earlier years from the Ritzbahs, but the thing against the Orot, you have a letter here signed by Rav Sonnenfeld and Rabbi Diskin, in which it says that the rabbis need to get together and join with us to agree that it's forbidden to listen to Rav Kook's writings, and that you have to agree with us that it's you can't listen to Rav Kook's Havalah, the Halomota, basically putting in Chayrim the writings of Rav Kook. So Rav Harap says, how can these rabbis, why didn't they turn to Rav Kook and ask him to explain his views? They actually live in the same, not just in the same city, in the same neighborhood, in Jerusalem. They should ask him their kushyot. And if he can't explain himself, or they don't like his answers, then they have the permission, let's say Rishut HaRabim, to go out into the public and condemn the writings. But this isn't what they did. They didn't turn to him at all. They didn't tell him about all the letters being sent to Chutz Laaretz. And then Rav Harap says, I was asked by Isaac Ben Tovim to give an explanation, and I explained it, and we published it. It's called Tovim Orot. And then he says, the truth is that these young people, these young fanatics, they published the letter of the rabbis in here without their knowledge at all. And not only that, he says, Hosifu Cherpa Ubuz, they degraded Rav Kook and also myself. And we know here that there are those Shevkiru Asmam, that they their whole life is, you know, mocking the great rabbi. And they are the ones who pulled in, through their conniving, they dragged in the other rabbis, Rav Sonnenfeld and Rabbi Diskin, into this. Rav Harap tells us, that there was a gathering of rabbis in Asifa to deal with the book Orot, that is of these Rav Diskin or Sonnenfeld. And the agreement that they made was that when they wrote against it, because they were going to write against it, they weren't going to say anything, no chiruf egidyuf, no words of real terrible condemnation. They simply were going to write to the rabbis of Europe and ask them to look at should such a book have been made public. And then, when they got the answers from the rabbis in Chutz Laaretz, then they would have made their decision what to do. And they would have done this with the plan was to do this by including Rav Kook in their deliberations. But the Aze Panim Hatzirim, these young fanatical extremists, they know Ribonam, they know their masters, their rabbis, namely from the Eda Charedit, and they rebel against them. They know, he says, that if the rabbis ask Rav Kook what the issues are in this book, you know what he's saying, he'll explain it to them. And then there won't be a problem. And then they'll lose their entire reason for living, namely, Lahadil HaMachoket. Their whole life is about creating conflict. And if they don't have that, then what are they going to do? And therefore, he says, they printed the book, and this is true, by the way, they printed the Kol HaShofar without even telling the rabbis. The rabbis had written something which they were to send to the rabbis of Europe, which is mostly private. And they published it. They made it public. And when the rabbis asked them, and Rav Harap knows all these rabbis very well, and when the rabbis asked them, how could they do this? They said, "Bimkom sheyesh chil Hashem, ein chokin kavod urav." When there's a chil Hashem, you don't even give kavod to the rabbis. That is, that you rabbis, you weren't doing as much as you should be doing. You're being tactful and writing to Europe and taking it slowly. And no, we need to fight against this heretic Kook. And so they did it on their own. And then he says that the true pious ones know the holiness of Rav Kook. And then he goes on and says that that Rav Kook and I, we've accepted the Yisurim, the terrible things that the Kol Shofar said about us. And we assume that everyone would know that it's forged, that it's nonsense, it's incorrect, it's forgeries, things like that. Because after all, how they never called us to a Beit Din, they never did anything like this. Then he says, he talks about how before all this, Rav Kook worked closely with Rav Sonnenfeld. In 1914, Rav Kook was together with Rav Sonnenfeld and myself, and we went to the Moshavot, that is these settlements in the Galil. And then Rav Sonnenfeld, and they call him Hagaon, Yosef Chaim, he saw how Rav Kook is able to work for all levels, the irreligious and the religious. The Kidei Shem Shemayim Barabim, and he was Mekadei Shem Shemayim by bringing certain Jews from these kibbutzim to do tshuva. And Rav Sonnenfeld himself, he says, listened to whatever Rav Kook would tell him, he listened to. Even in areas of things he had never done before. For example, he tells a story about there's a moshav called Puria, which is next to Tiberias. And there was a group of workers there, most, he says, from Warsaw and Galicia, and they were completely Mechal Shabbos, they ate non-kosher, and Rav Kook went into their kitchen and spoke to them patiently, and he danced with them, and he ordered, Vitziva, it says, he ordered Rav Sonnenfeld to dance together with them, and they all danced together, these irreligious kibbutzniks, Rav Kook and Rav Sonnenfeld, Va'al Yedei Elul HaRakidot, and because of these dances, and the spiritual connection that Rav Kook was able to make with these people, he was able to convince them to kosher their kitchen, ulahamid lahem mevashel isha kashera, and to bring in a kosher woman who will be the cook and make sure everything is kosher. So here you have an irreligious kibbutz, that because of what Rav Kook did, and Rav Sonnenfeld saw all this, they agreed to make a kosher kitchen. V'higil kolehem. This is famous, by the way. They koshered the dishes, the pots, then Rav Kook was involved with it. And then on Shabbos, they all rested. And he says it was a great wonder. This is a famous story, incidentally. And he says this is just one of the great things Rav Kook has done. And if these fanatics had not degraded Rav Kook the way they did, then everyone would see this, how much Rav Kook had done. And then it says, but unfortunately, because of what they've done, they've spread disputes. They've caused Rav Sonnenfeld and Rabbi Diskin, that's Rabbi Yerucham Diskin, the son of the first Yehuda Leib Diskin, they've caused a break between these great rabbis. And he says they're great. And but he says that this is what's caused the break. And then he says, no, you, rabbis and tzaddikim chutz la'aretz, don't be quick to make any steps or judgments against Maran Shlita, that's Rav Kook. He says again, if anything is problematic, turn to Rav Kook. Ignore all these people who are condemning him, etc. The Baalei Machloket. And then he says, you need to know that the whole purpose of Rav Kook in his wonderful works and his holy works is just to show how in today's day and age we can bring back those who have fallen. How are we supposed to bring them? He says there are ways to increase Avat Yisrael and to recognize their holiness, that is, the irreligious holiness, and to be Mohammed Schut on them. And then he says, okay, and then he says, I know my meaninglessness, etc. And then he has a second letter, which is written already in the summer. This is after the Ger Rebbe's visit. He doesn't say in the first letter, show it to the Ger Rebbe. The implication was clearly he would. In the second letter, he says, thank you for mentioning me before the Rebbe. Obviously, something else he wrote. And then this is another letter. Let me read you one section of it. He says, again, this is after the Ger Rebbe had come to Jerusalem and had had his discussions. Then he returned. Then Rav Harlap writes. And Rav Harlap says, presumably because the Ger Rebbe had raised certain issues, and the Ger Rebbe, and Rav Harlap says, I wonder, did you show my letter to the Ger Rebbe? And he says, if the Ger Rebbe had looked, if the Admor Shlita had looked over my letters, then he'd know the truth. And then, you know, then he would know how to make peace. So Rav Harlap was concerned that his letter was not shown. And then he says, all the stuff you're hearing from the fanatics, there isn't even a tiny bit of proof of truth. They were saying that Rav Kook is the, you know, accepts the irreligious and doesn't care if they observe Torah and just wants their respect and things like that. He says, Rav Kook is halochem hayachidi bedorenu. He is the only one in today's day and age who's fighting the war for Torah. But of course he fights it a different way. And he says, not, you know, like the others who are locked up in their house, but he is on the battlefield itself. He goes into the battlefield and he fights face to face. And not with Devarim below Tom, not just with screaming and things like that, but with Devarim Shel Tom. He explains to them these things. And holy words come out of his mouth, etc. And then he says, it's very unfortunate that I have to say that it's a terrible mistake if you think that this dispute that's going on in Jerusalem now in 1921 is because of what they're saying, these people in Jerusalem are saying, because of Rav Kook's bad ideas, etc. Not at all. He says if it was just for the rabbis, they could come for peace, it wouldn't be any problem. In fact, the previous year, he said, the rabbis got together, and the three great rabbis, Rav Kook, Rav Diskin, and Rav Zonnenfeld, got together, and he says, I went as well, and they agreed, that is, these rabbis agreed, that different approaches for each one of them. Namely, that Rav Kook's idea, Rav Kook, when you needed someone to speak to the irreligious, when you needed someone who can speak the nachat, the tam, to winhog milchama b'shalom, that is, to fight the battle through peaceful means, then that would be the role of Rav Kook. And he says, but when it comes a time that you need to go out birash ma'at, you know, it'll be a little bit loud, then that'll be the job of Rav Zonnenfeld and Rav Diskin. And he says that they agreed to this, that they wouldn't attack Rav Kook because they know that Rav Kook is doing what he needs to do. And then sometimes they would need to make more noise when they thought Rav Kook wasn't achieving, but all working together. And they would join together and strategize on all these things. And everyone would know that whatever was said from any of them had the agreement of all of them. And Rav Harap says that they practically agreed to this Seder. But after, when they separated, after the meeting went their own way, the Satan came, namely these Ketanim, who were only want to do Machoket and Lashon Hara all their life. They did not allow it to, they did not allow things to progress. And Rav Harap says, nevertheless, Rav Kook still treats these elderly rabbis with respect and derech eretz. And he invited them, despite the fact that they refused to work with him. He has invited him to the meeting when they wanted to make the whole, you know, the religious life with the chief rabbin. He invited them to come there. And even when Rav Zonnenfeld was made a counter-rabbi, the rabbi of the extremists, Rav Kook still treated him with respect, he says, and still consulted with him. And then it says, only later, when the Kol HaShofar appeared, and they didn't show any derech eretz to Rav Kook, only then was there a break between the older rabbis, Rav Diskin, Rav Zonnenfeld, and Rav Kook. And nevertheless, Rav Kook, when the chief rabbinate issue came up, Rav Kook still turned to them. That's pretty much... the final thing I want to call your attention to. He says, ta'ot muchletati. He says, it's a complete error to think that our approach, darchenu, he's saying our approach, me and Rav Kook, is chalila hitarvut tovara, that we are mixing evil and good together. That's what the opponent said. That Rav Kook, he's taking heresy and mixing it with Torah, etc. He says, just the opposite. All we want is the pirut hatov min hara, separating good from evil. But we say, we're not going to arrive at that by separating between Jews. What do? We love all the Jews and keep all the Jews close, but however, we try to separate the Tov from the Ra. Not the Jews, one from the other. Not good Jews and bad Jews. We don't separate them. We keep all Jews together, and we separate the bad from the good inside them. Furthermore, we try to separate between Kodesh and Chol. We do separate between Kodesh and Chol. But we also say, everything that's done, b'tzad hachol, together with the chol, for Medinyut Yisrael, for the politics, I guess you should say, of Israel, v'chokin yanyam, HaKodesh Hu Tom Chotol, that holiness supports it. V'lulei HaKodesh Lohayaba. So in other words, it's not that we support the secular and we mix the secular. It's just that what appears to be secular, building up the land, let's say, that has holiness inside it. Nevertheless, we haven't given any inyan of Kodesh, any matter of holiness, to those hands of chol. That is, we keep the holiness to ourselves and try to bring it out in the others. But we don't allow them to control what's holy. You know, we don't allow the secularists to determine anything about Torah or anything like that. And in the end, saying that, we have to put a stop to all the separations between us and stop the Sinat Chinam, etc., etc. He ends, I'm not a politician, but I'm crying over the terrible situation here. We all are thrilled that, the Ger Rebbe... Oh, no, this is before the Ger Rebbe came. This is before, because he says that we're thrilled that the Ger Rebbe will be coming to Jerusalem, etc. And we hope he will find a way to stop the conflict that's going on. So what did the Ger Rebbe do? He comes to Jerusalem. He meets... He goes to Rav Kook first. Rav Kook he always went to Rav Kook. He came five times. He goes to Rav Kook, then he goes to Rav Zonnenfeld. He's unable to make peace. He's very impressed with Rav Kook, very impressed with Rav Harlap, but he doesn't buy Rav Kook's explanations. And he writes in his famous letter, which was a couple years later, he writes that how Rav Kook is such a genius and holy, but... he's an individual, and he mentions one of the sages in the Talmud who is so pious and so exalted, and even beyond everyone else, but because he's an individual, we don't hold like him, and he says that Rav Kook's ideas are no rote. The ideas of trying to, you know, see the holiness in the secular, that's not our approach. But the fact that he regards Rav Kook as his Gadol Shebigdolim, that becomes more important in the history of how the Hasidim related to Rav Kook, because what this means is that every Ger Hasid has to relate to Rav Kook as a Gon Shebegonim. You can't relate to him like, these Hungarians and related to him. But the Ger Rebbe did more than that. In addition to trying to make peace, he tried to get Rav Kook to retract some of his more extreme formulations in Orot. And Rav Kook agreed. Rav Kook agreed that we don't know what formulations... But it has to be what he says that, wrote, 34, that the exercise of the Chalutzim is equal to the recitations of Psalms. And Rav Kook agrees. Rav Chaim Hirschenson wrote a letter to Rav Kook. How could you agree to this? And Rav Kook says, it's okay. I haven't agreed to withdraw any of my important points. Only some of the formulations that people could misunderstand. And the idea was to publicly retract it, and then he could publish a new Orot without these in. The problem was that the other side, the extremist side in Jerusalem, they had to agree to stop attacking Rav Kook and attacking Orot if he took out some of these formulations, and they refused to do that. So, as Rav Kook explained, since the other side refused to go along with this compromise suggested by the Ger Rebbe, Rav Kook felt that he was not obligated himself to, because they weren't going to accept him anyway, to alter any of his formulations. So in terms of the Ger Rebbe coming to make peace, he was unsuccessful. Not only was he unsuccessful, but he then became subject to the attack of the extremists. Pashkevillian went up attacking the Ger Rebbe. They wrote, Matza Minet Mino, that is, one heretic found, it's a play on words, one type found another type. But it also means one heretic finds another heretic. And that really turned off the Polish Agudas Yisrael from the Yeda Charedit. If you recall, last class, when I spoke about how the Agudas Yisrael of Europe was turned against the separatist movement, once the non-Hasidim, it took them a little longer, but once the Ger Rebbe was attacked, and there wasn't any condemnation, even though everyone knew that the rabbis had nothing to do with this, and the rabbis were very respectful, that is, Razon and Fodor Diskin, were very respectful of the Ger Rebbe, but their community never threw out these people, never did anything, because they never do anything. Not then and not now, when the crazies in their community act. Just yesterday, they hung up effigies of Israeli soldiers. And they do unbelievable, terrible stuff. But the community itself never, the reasonable people are always afraid, they're afraid they'll be attacked, so they never say anything. Once that happened, the Polish Aguda, which was the Ger Chasidus, basically washed their hands of the Eid HaCharedit and wanted nothing to do with them, and no involvement in separatism. The same thing happened when the Lubavitch Rebbe then came a few years later, and he also met with Rav Kook. They attacked him. What they were trying to do was make it that no one could visit Rav Kook without being assaulted. These extremists were even attacked by Rav Alfandari, who was this great Makubo, an elderly Sephardi halachist and Makubo, who the Munkat Sherav thought was the Mashiach. There's a whole story. When we do classes on the Munkat Sherav, we'll have to speak about how the Munkat Sherav, this connection to Rav Alfandari, but Rav Karlap turned to Rav Alfandari. Rav Alfandari disagreed with Rav Kook terribly in so many areas, philosophically, halachically, when it came to Shemitah. But Rav Alfandari writes that these people, these young fanatics who are defaming Rav Kook, they need to be punished even with monetary punishments. That is, that their community can fine them, and that they need to be basically run out of town. And Rav Sonnenfeld didn't approve of these attacks, and Rav Diskin didn't approve of these attacks. But again, not approving of these attacks and publicly condemning them are two separate things. And I hate to say it, but the rabbinic leadership of the Eid HaCharedit has never had any backbone, not then, not now, and has never condemned. Rav Sternbach, perhaps, he's condemned some of the crazies today. And of course, they attack him for that. But if you look at the history of the Eid HaCharedit rabbinate, they've never had any backbone. And I'm talking about great scholars, great sages who published important halachic works, but they've never been able to stand up to the crazies in their own community. And whether because for Shem Shemayim reasons that they don't want to split their community, or whether they're afraid themselves that they'll be assaulted. And they if you stand up against these people, they can handle it. It doesn't matter. Amram Blau, the head of the Turei Karta, when he went against them and he married the convert, Ruth Blau, when they told him not to, the man who was front and center, who was their leader of all the extremists, they turned against him, and the fact that he was their leader yesterday didn't mean anything. So there's a lot to be said about that. In the Kol HaShofar, I sent out to a couple of you, you requested I can send out to any of you. As I mentioned, it's a rare pamphlet because HebrewBooks.org and Otzar HaChachma refused to put this booklet online, even though this is the most important document of the opposition to Rav Kook in Jerusalem in the 1920s. So I don't think any of Rav Kook's followers today, I think, want to see this to know what the opposition was. Maybe I should put it online on a Sfarim blog post, and it'll be online permanently. But on page 6 and 7, that's where you get the, and page 12, that's where you get the attack on Rav Charlap. It's no longer just Rav Kook. Once Rav Charlap defends Rav Kook and Tovi Ma'o wrote, then he is thrown in together with him, and they make fun of him as the prophet. Rav Kook is the prophet, and Rav Charlap is his seer. They think the Geula is already here. And like I said, page 6 to 7, as you see the attack against Rav Charlap for his Tovi Ma'orot. One other passage from the extremists, I'll read you. Rav Kook mentions this in his one of his books, Amarot HaRot. He says as follows: the extremists, they're choshe. They suspect me that I don't have sin, a hatred for the evil. And he says that's completely false. He says, on the contrary, I've increased my sinat Torah. However, once I came to learn the shorish of the Ra, that is the essence, the source of the evil. My battle is against the shoresh of the evil. And I have mercy, l'rachem, on the afim, the branches. What he's saying is that I fight the evil at its root. I have mercy on the branches. The branches are the people who have these bad ideas. Our battle is not with the people with these ideas. Our battle is with the ideas. So we need to explain to people that atheism is a false ideology, and we need to show them why it's an incorrect ideology, and why communism and all these things. We fight the ideology. That's the root. The anafim, the branches, the people, he says, I've now learned to have rachamim on them. If that isn't Kirov, I don't know what is. That's the whole basis of Kirov today. If you look back at the way the Chasam Sofer attacked the irreligious, they didn't distinguish between the bad idea and the good people. The people who held the Reform ideology need to be battled, need to be put outside of our community. What does Kirov today say? No, and all Kirov says this, that we distinguish between the ideas and the people. The people are good, they just have to be led by bad ideas. That's exactly what Rav Karl Lapp is saying here. It's, of course, Rav Kook's ideas. The Shoresh is Mavaldo Mochot Bnei Adam, Umazikotam. Shemagvidat Einam Yodi, Mechashayer Me'ra Shoreshi. It's these ideas, something Rav Kook himself develops, that the generation are all have the status of Onsim. They're compelled almost to be heretics because the ideas out there in the world. Look around today. It's a miracle that anyone has traditional Jewish ideas. The pressure of the media and of contemporary culture is such that if someone comes to, let's say, adopt an idea that goes against our tradition, we can't see this person as evil. This person is in the status of an onus. He's basically forced, just like you're forced to do a sin. You're forced to, it's convinced you. So you're not consciously choosing to reject the Torah. You've become convinced because of the forces in the air, which they're strong today. They were even stronger in the 1910s and the 1920s with all these ideologies. And that's what Rav Karl Lapp is saying. And I don't know if you have these ideas in Rav Hirsch. So what we need to continue doing now, I see, I told you this is not going to go quickly. These are very important ideas, and I think because of Rav Karl Lapp, especially with Rav Karl Lapp, you're getting footnotes on Rav Kook. Rav Karl Lapp's entire life is a series of notes to Rav Kook. So Rav Kook, who's so important, the most important of the great rabbis of the 20th century, I think, you're getting, through Rav Karl Lapp, we're getting explanations and a way to view him. There's so much more we need to see, though. Next class, a new material published by Rav Karl Lapp, where we see his inner thoughts, just came out a couple of years ago. And then we pick up with our story again. The chief rabbinate, the death of Rav Kook, the separation of Rav Kook, when Rav Kook is in England, then the death of Rav Kook, then the new chief rabbi, and who is it going to be? Is it going to be Rav Karl Lapp, or is it going to be Rabbi Herzog? And and the partition, more important ideas. So we have a lot to do. But I hope that at least we've only done three classes now. Both the people here now and the people who are listening and who are going to be emailing me, you see that Rav Karl Lapp, you see his significance. First of all, as we'll see his significance, he comes into his own after Rav Kook passes away. Until Rav Kook dies, he's really, as I said, the consigliere, or whatever term you want to use. He's I wouldn't say he's a spokesman, but he's the advocate of Rav Kook, the polemicist of Rav Kook, and we'll see next class as well. Not just the friend, the two are so enmeshed. But there's still a lot to do, and as always, it'll be combined with the thought of Rav Kook, the thought of Rav Karl Lapp, and also the very important issues that take place in the land of Israel in the 1930s and 1940s. So now I have to stop. As I don't know if you could see here, we have so much to get to. All of these books and all of these papers, the important stuff. It's taken me a long time to repair these classes. Part of the problem is there's no books on Rav Karl Lapp, really. There's a hagiography, but nothing about his ideas in the book form. I found an article or two, but I really spent months going through his writings, pulling out the stuff that I think that my listeners, all of you, would find interesting, and really that's the stuff that I find interesting. When you think there's thousands of pages of Ahronap, I have to be selective in what I pick. But I think I'm picking the stuff that really speaks to the big issues. Okay, so some questions now, everyone. Let me go back. Moshe says, did Rav Kook and Rav Harop identify themselves more with Hasidim than the standard? Okay, it's an excellent question. The people who knew Rav Kook, who used to go to Hushal Shudas, would describe him as a Hasidic Rebbe. The way Rav Harop relates to Rav Kook, as we'll see soon, is like a Hasidic Rebbe. Rav Harop himself is not a Hasid and doesn't have Hasidic ideas. He's a follower of the Vilna Gaon. People related to him, though, however, as like a tzaddik. Rav Kook had, unlike Rav Harlap, who doesn't quote Hasidic texts, everything he's quoting is Kabbalistic texts, he quotes the Gra, the Ramchal, things like that. Rav Kook quotes Hasidic texts and was very close to many Hasidic figures, including the Rishon dynasty figures in Israel. He has this notion of the tzaddik, so much so that Smadar Shurlo's book on Rav Kook, look what it's called, Tzaddik Yesod Olam. Yet, if you look at the classic works of Rav Kook, published after his death, you don't see any of these things. That's because Tzvi Yehuda, his son, was much more in line with the Masnagdic tradition. Basically, Merkaz HaRav for Tzvi Yehuda was the continuation of Volozhin. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda refused, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda was a big opponent of Hasidus. He says, he would make these negative comments about Hasidus. He didn't like it at all. He was really a Vilna Gaon person. The problem is that his very father, his own father, very complicated, obviously, Rav Kook, but his own father had a much more positive attitude towards Hasidus. I mentioned this in my last book. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda, therefore, did not publish the writings of Rav Kook, in which you see his more positive attitude towards Hasidus, and in particular, the idea of the tzaddik, the Hasidic idea of the tzaddik. Now, with the Shmona Kvatzim, we see this. So Rav Kook was really in the middle. On the one hand, he's very attached to the Gra and that whole Lithuanian tradition. He comes out of Volozhin. On the other hand, he is very attached to Hasidic models, which are very non-Lithuanian, and it's something his own son could not handle. So I wouldn't say that Rav Harlap certainly didn't identify with the Hasidim, but Rav Kook did identify. You read some of his writings, and he does identify. At the same time, he identifies with the Misnagdim, but in terms of the importance of Talmud study. But in terms of the ideas of the Tzaddik, and the Rebbe is another way of putting it, he has writings which could come directly out of Hasidic text. Let me mention one more point, Moshe. And this is a great example to show you how the very same thing could be. I said this once, I don't know if it was how many semesters ago, but it's worth repeating. The very fact, if you're positively inclined to Rav Kook, you say it one way, and if you're negatively, you'll say it another way. Rav Kook would often be visited by Hasidic figures. The Hasidim, especially the Polish Hasidim, were very attached to him. And after the Ger Rebbe, it's a famous letter, he becomes important for them as well. But when all these people would come in, if you're from the Chassachat Shavers, Rav Kook knew you were coming. I mean, they had an appointment. He would talk to you. He would always make sure to tell you over some Torah from the Chassachat Shavers. If you're a Kutzker, from the Kutzker, the Gerer, from the Sfas Emes. If you're Chabad, from the Tanya. I mean, he always did that. So the anti-Rav Kook people, in one of their volumes against him, they're trying to show that Rav Kook is a charlatan. Now, how do they show he's a charlatan? They quote from the memoir of one of these followers of Rav Kook, where he talks about how whoever would come to visit with Rav Kook would make sure to speak to them something from, you know, their Rebbe, their Hasidic tradition. So what does this person say? He says it shows what a charlatan Rav Kook is. The person, he knows that, let's say, this Rishon Chassid is coming, so he prepares something so he can impress the Rishon or Chassid, makes the Rishon or Chassid like him, something like that. Any person who looks at this fairly would say just the opposite. Rav Kook has connections to all these people, and since the Rishon or Chassid is coming, he wants to create a spiritual connection by sharing some words of Torah from their Rebbe. And you have to be really, blind, I think, to see this as an example of a charlatan, of trying to impress people. But Rav Kook knew all the Hasidic works and quoted them. Then Moshe says, that's the question. Moshe also says his independence in thought and practice and similarities to Hasidim, especially his outreach, which brings to mind with Simcha Vyunim. That's I think, what troubled Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Some of these ideas, even the antinomian ideas that you sometimes see in Rav Kook, you could find parallels in the Hasidic texts, he moves beyond the Hasidic. When the Ger Rebbe spoke to him, he says, Ger Rebbe said to him, this stuff about the exercise, this you have to take out. And Rav Kook says that, but the Mor Nevuchim, speaks about how you have to have a strong body. So the Ger Rebbe says, we don't learn the Mor Nevuchim. So, Rav Kook is much broader, because it's not just the Hasidus. It's the Mora, it's the philosophy, it's everything. Rav Harlap is not broad like that. But I was shocked to see some of this book, which I'm going to talk about next week, Maimarom, volume 18, called Razili, which it's basically, it's a Shmona Kvatzim of Rav Harlap. It's only published in 2012. Before this, I had no idea that Rav Harlap wrote like this. He basically is copying Rav Kook's way of writing with short aphorisms and short sections. And some of the stuff he says is really interesting, and he even responds here. He's going to explain to us next week how it is that great tzaddikim can make such errors. And you also see the flip side, why Rav Kook, he never mentions it by name, but why Rav Kook doesn't make these errors, and why, how the tzaddikim are limited, whereas Rav Kook is so broad. So that's, here's that book, Razigri. I wonder if they've censored anything, because if you know Rav Harlap's family, some of his descendants are very much in the Haredi world. I have to give him a lot of credit for publishing Razili. The stuff in there is not mainstream stuff by any means. But I do have to wonder if they've kept out some other stuff. Moshe says that a friend of his was recently Rav David Soloveitchik's Chumashir, and to the surprise of everyone, Rav David brought up Rav Kook and said Rav Kook was a great tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, but his Mahalach is very different and we don't follow it. I would not be surprised for the simple reason that is what the Brisker Rav said almost word for word. If you look in the letters of the Brisker Rav writes to Rav Kook with requests, but the Brisker Rav gives him these highfalutin titles. And the story is that he had respect for him in his learning, but his derech is completely different, but he was careful not to defame him in any way like that. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda used to go to the Brisker Rav's shir. And he used to go there, Rav Aryeh Levin, told Rav Tzvi Yehuda he can't go, because when you go there, some of the people who'd be at the shir were these extremists who'd also go to the shir, and they'd knock Rav Kook and say terrible things, and it was causing Rav Tzvi Yehuda a lot of tzaras. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda says, it's worth getting the Torah, the Brisker Rav, even if I have to hear this. But the Brisker Rav itself, now I just was reading, this new book, here. See if I can, Besarat Eish, it's this new thing that came out on Rav Shach by one of his Gaboim, and in there, I can't find the passage here, but in there he quotes the Rav Shach as saying that he was surprised that the Brisker Rav said about Rav Kook, basically, that he was something like that. I have to find it. Like, he's a tzaddik, but just misguided. That, the Rav Shach was surprised that I'll find the exact quote for next time, that Rav Shach was surprised that the Brisker Rav had that view. You don't want to bring up Rav Kook's ideas. But on a personal level, I don't know of any authentic sources that have the Brisker Rav defaming Rav Kook personally. Same things like, he has crazy ideas. And since you mentioned the Briskerov, when someone was ill, and the Briskerov wanted someone to daven, he sent the person to Rav Charlap. The Briskerov regarded Rav Charlap as the tzaddik of Jerusalem. And when someone was ill, or even in his own family, he wanted Rav Charlap to daven. You can't exactly regard Rav Kook negatively if you think Rav Charlap is the tzaddik of the generation in Jerusalem. What you can say, however, is, and the Briskerov would say this, that Rav Charlap is the tzaddik, but he's not the Talmud Chacham, and you can be the tzaddik hador, but also be completely misguided in your philosophy. Rav Zonnenfeld almost said the same thing about Rav Kook. Rav Zonnenfeld said that Rav Kook's problem is that he's living as, he doesn't see the here and now. He sees everything through messianic lens and through a mystical lens, but when we decide, when we deal with the irreligious, we have to see the here and now. The halacha tells us we have to judge them by what our eyes see. And instead, Rav Kook is not using his eyes, he's looking into their soul. And Rav Zonnenfeld says, that's not how you judge things. That's not a, Rav Soloveitchik would say the same thing. Rav Zonnenfeld said this in an interview with Hillel Zeitlin. Hillel Zeitlin comes to Jerusalem, and he wants to know about the dispute. And he goes to Rav Zonnenfeld, and Rav Zonnenfeld says that Rav Kook is not in this world. He's in a different world. That it is still, though, I say this to you, what the Briskerov must have thought, but it is a bit strange, I think, that if you think that Rav Charlap is the tzaddik, normally when you think someone is the greatest tzaddik, you don't think that his ideas are completely out there. The two usually go together, but there's no question that the Briskerov thought that Rav Charlap as a tzaddik was exceptional, even unique, but his ideas were not... maybe you can. Maybe as a Brisker you could say that halacha and hashkafa have to be decided by halacha, by the here and now. And since Rav Charlap is in the stratosphere, you'll see some of the things he says next week. You'll wonder about, is he really in this world or not? If someone would say them today, you'd say that he's maybe missing something, because Rav Charlap, the visions he's having visions, and he's connecting to, just wait, after Rav Kook dies, what he does. But that's a fact, that the Briskerov, despite opposing every single view of Rav Kook and Rav Charlap, he thought that Rav Charlap was the tzaddik and the one whose prayers would be answered before anyone else. You say source. I don't know which source you're referring to, Moshe. You ask me, I'll tell you what the source is. If you're asking the source for Tzvi Yehuda, I don't know. I'll wait for Moshe to type it, and then we'll say... and I'll find the source for next week, what it says in this book. Briskerov Center of Charlap. I mean, this is famous, but what's the source? An easy source to give you. I'll find an easy source... for next class. This is a Davar Yadua, but I will get you actual source. So we even have pictures. We have pictures of the Briskerov together with Rav Charlap, both at weddings and sitting at the same table. Okay, I'll try to find a good source for that as well. For those of you who are in New York, stay safe. The rest of you, see you next week. Good night, everyone.